From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The pianist Leslie Howard is regarded throughout the world not just for his virtuosity, but for his feats in the recording studio. Howard has recorded the entire known collection of Franz Liszt's piano work. It's been called the largest recording project in history. It took almost two decades. It's 120 hours of playing, 97 CDs. Someone figured it was more than 12 miles of printed music, which included some 10 million notes. Howard's energy for such an exhausting project reveals more than just a passing affection for the composer. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Leslie Howard. We'll talk about Liszt, but about his own life, too, and the technique that has made him one of the best pianists in the world. Leslie Howard today, after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Much has been written about the pianist Leslie Howard's connection to Franz Liszt. Howard has recorded the entire collection of the composer's piano work, some 97 CDs in all. It's a nearly 20-year project. While it doesn't define Leslie Howard's far-reaching career, his passion for Liszt may explain his own energy for life and his love for music. Next week, Leslie Howard is returning to Salt Lake City for a concert at the Cathedral Church of St. Mark. And today we're rebroadcasting an earlier conversation with him. He was with us in the studio and behind a piano.
Let me ask you, first of all, if I could talk. I want to talk about your how it is you started playing. Artists sometimes and musicians often talk about those kind of epiphanal moments when there was something that inspired them or transported them. Did that happen to you in terms of music?
I don't know, because I started playing so young.
Did you?
It was before I could... I was able to play the piano before I was able to read. So
wow.
I started when I was about two, just copying what I could hear.
Not because you were expected to, because you wanted to.
That's right. There was a piano there, and I worked out that it made noises, and they were all different one from another, which is what most kids don't do, because most kids just hit clusters of notes. And I must have developed perfect pitch very early, because I could just copy tunes that I heard on the radio, and that's how it started.
So do you remember at what point you became conscious of the fact that you had been given this gift?
I suppose as soon as I went to school, because I realized I was the only one who could do what I could do. There were some other kids who eventually learned to play, but I had a bit of a head start on them, I think, so... I remember being very annoyed that I had to slow down in order to learn to read music, because I played by ear when I started. And, I used to go and play for the hymns at Sunday school, and used to play for singing at school assembly, because I just knew how the tunes went. But then I had to learn properly, and then I had to read music, and boy, I didn't like that at all, because it meant I had to play much simpler pieces until my reading caught up with my playing. I remember that very well.
So but, it wasn't as joyful for a while there.
When I was about four and a half to five, there was a rough patch. Yes,
but then you put it all together, then it was okay.
It was, and in the British world, you have these examinations that you do more or less every year for the Associated Board, and you do your grade one and your grade two and so on and so forth, and that became just a regular thing, and I was. I suppose I was about one of the youngest to be doing whatever grade it was I was doing at the time. And it was always pretty clear to me that I was going to play the piano.
Yeah. Because you wanted to, again.
Yes. Oh, yes.
You weren't burdened by this notion of being a prodigy then.
No, and my parents were very good because they didn't let me be a kind of performing seal. I went to normal school and did things other kids did and got into trouble just the way other kids do, and played games. I'm not very good at sport, but I played it, and and got interested in lots of other things. And in fact, there was a long time there I was quite determined to go to university and read physics, but in the end I went and did English literature instead. The last thing I knew I would ever do would be to go to a music conservatory. I didn't want to do that at all.
Why?
I don't like the curriculum of almost any of them, because it's too narrow.
Yeah.
I've never understood why musicians think that the only way to learn music is to cut yourself off from everything else. And because everything in music that I know about has got connections with other things. And, you know, I think the more you know about literature and the more you know about modern languages and the more you know about painting and the more you know about social history, the better informed you are as an executant. And I wish there were a few people who... I mean, you know, when I give masterclasses quite often, and you know, people come to you with a piece, say like the Liszt Dante Sonata, and so you ask almost innocently what they can possibly tell you about Dante, and quite often they don't know who that is. and this is particularly true, I'm sorry to say, in some of the places that I've travelled in the Far East, where the actual technical preparation of the students is fantastic. But the background information is often very difficult for them to come by because, you know, they pass around copies of music that they take down off the net because there aren't that many music publishers there that have reliable editions of Western music. And so, you know, there they are playing the first Mephisto waltz of Liszt, and so you ask them, well, who's this Mephisto fellow? they don't know. The worst one I encountered was a girl who played very well the Don Giovanni fantasy. And she was quite unaware that Don Giovanni was an opera by Mozart and was none the wiser when it was explained to her. I just didn't have the slightest conception of why Liszt would have written a fantasy based on somebody else's opera or what went on in this opera.
Yeah.
And it was very hard to get a performance, therefore, that sounded at all convincing. I mean, the notes were all there,
yeah,
fantastically well. It just didn't mean anything.
So how do you... Can you teach that? I mean, again, this is that I guess that part that
I
is...
I think only by example and enthusiasm.
Hmm.
But, you know, when you get a good student who's sufficiently fired to go off and have a look at what the background to his pieces might be, then... You're in with a shout.
So does that mean that is there some answer to your virtuosity, your capacity behind the piano? Is it that you have a sense of, you know, not just you know something about the composer? That is, you have to understand what they were getting at when they were writing this piece.
Well, I think that's very important, and in any case, it's not that difficult to find out.
Yeah.
I mean, for us, you know, there are libraries everywhere. I must say I'm always amazed at how little use is made of them by students, but they're there, and they're not difficult to use. In fact, they're much easier to use than they used to be because, you know, all the catalogues are on computers, and all you do is go up to a screen and bash in one word,
right,
and it
and
does the
are.
Rest, you know.
So that's important to you. So what did you find yourself as you were preparing for these pieces? Before you were willing to say, to give it to an audience, you had to understand it?
I always have done that since I was very small. Yeah, I would hate to play a piece by a composer about whom I knew nothing.
Yeah.
It's very rarely happened. Sometimes in the Liszt series it was a bit difficult because he'd arranged music by very obscure people. And to find out anything about some of them was quite a challenge. For example, he wrote a little valse mazurka called Una Stella Amica, which is a friendly star. And it's based on music by one Francesco Pezzini. All I can find out about Francesco Pezzini was that he conducted a band in Rome, brass band, in the 1870s. And Liszt must have met him and must have done this as a favor. But I've never found any more music by F. Pezzini. And, you know, I drew a blank on that one. but, for example, when he did an operatic fantasy on an opera called Tony, which was composed by the Duke Ernst of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, who was one of Queen Victoria's cousins, there was something you could find out about him.
Right, right.
Unfortunately, nothing much that saved his music. But
you know, it's interesting. There's also something that you said once about the catalog, as I mentioned, some 14-year process, is that you felt like you had to perform these pieces before the public before you recorded them?
That is my preference for recording anything.
Why?
There's a danger when you go into a recording studio of not giving a performance, you know, of just putting down the notes, of making a document, if you like, because you can. And because of the way recordings are made, you know perfectly well if it isn't right the first time, you can take it the 25th time. And and if you're worried about doing that, it's also... it's possible to take a slightly slower tempo, not for the whole piece, but, you know, just for example, if there's a big leap in both directions at once, where in a concert normally you'd take a risk, and 9 times out of 10 you'd get it. But on the record, you can't have this 10th time where you miss it. So instead of just going for it, you go for it a little more carefully. And, you know, it's... and then it just doesn't come off. You know, it's like what you can't do if you're a ballet dancer. And you have to do an entrechat. There's no way you can do it slowly. there's only one speed at which that job can be done. And... So I always like to put the pieces out and from memory in public, and because it means that I'll be more confident when I go in the studio that I can actually, you know, play a real performance.
You had a varied beginning. Didn't necessarily begin in the concert hall. Is it true you played in a topless restaurant?
Oh, dear. These things get around, don't they? It's not where I started, and thankfully not where I finished either. But when I first went to London from Melbourne, where I was born, I found it very difficult because I had been, I suppose, a fairly big fish in a fairly small pond, and no one in England was particularly interested that I'd arrived at all, which wasn't to be wondered at, but on the whole, England was quite slow. And just to start with, I just had to earn a living, stay alive, pay the rent, hire a piano, all of that sort of thing. And I played in a topless restaurant, which was a director's club, every lunchtime on the weekday. And I played in a very peculiar place in Mayfair of the evenings between 1 and 2 in the morning. This only lasted for about 6 months, but it helped.
Yeah.
And I taught some of the children of the rich and careless, and you know, kids who really didn't want to play at all. I had one who was the nephew of Fidel Castro.
Wow.
And you know, it's quite often you find people from the far left, in fact, we got loads of money and loads of relations who were very well healed. And these people lived in Eaton Square, which is one of the most expensive squares in London. And this kid tried to bribe me to let him watch television instead of have his piano lesson, you know, because he had more money than brains. And he just, you know, sort of fish out 20 quid, which in the early 70s was real money. And, you know, that was sort of a couple of weeks' rent then.
Tempting.
Yeah. You know, let's just watch the telly for half an hour. The nanny won't mind.
Nor tell.
Oh, dear.
Leslie Howard. He'll be in concert this coming Wednesday, November 14th, at 7:30. He's performing the works of Liszt, but also Beethoven and Rachmaninoff. It's at the Cathedral Church of St. Mark in Salt Lake City. For details and ticket information, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with the acclaimed pianist Leslie Howard.
Howard joined us in the studio behind a piano. He's giving a concert next week in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Leslie Howard, I wanted to ask you about how do you describe your connection to Franz Liszt?
Well, it started out just as curiosity, really. I mean, I loved the music.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I heard the sonata and the first time I heard the Faust Symphony, just being really amazed at the man's musical language. And it was very hard to find the music. And, you know, there are other composers in whom I've taken a great interest, but
sure.
On the whole, they're well covered by various artists. And I'd never stumbled across somebody who seemed to me to be in so much need of somebody to do some work. I suppose it's just daunting because of the size of the man's output. But the more you look into it and the more you find in the music and the more fascinating his life and its connection to his music becomes. And, I mean, he lived one of the largest lives of any musician ever. And he managed, He lived, I mean, a fairly worldly life, but also a very spiritual life, and he was welcome everywhere. He knew all of the crowned heads of state of Europe over a period of more than 50 years, and was a beloved son of the Vatican as well, and knew all of the royalty everywhere, consorted with duchesses, princesses, and countesses all his life, and one of them bore him three children, and the other one he lived with during his, well, I suppose, for the music that everybody knows by him, his most important period when he was in Weimar for 12 years as Kapellmeister, from which time comes the sonata, the symphonies, the symphonic poems, the Hungarian rhapsodies, the Année de Pèlerinage, the transcendental studies, you know, the things that most people know by him if they're just starting out. And I've never got tired of finding out things about him, and I'm in the throes of producing with a colleague of mine a thematic catalogue of all his works. That's been more than 10 years on the stocks too. It's just so hard to run every single thing to earth, and just when you think you've got something pinned down, you find that there's another version of the Angel's Chorus from Goethe's Faust. And he wrote loads and loads of music that no one even knows it exists, I suppose, unless they've really gone looking in obscure lists and catalogues. But like every composer in the 19th century, there was a certain amount of music for choir, for kind of practical use. He wrote 50 motets and 5 masses, but he also wrote lots of secular choruses for men's choral societies, and you know, women's choruses, a couple of children's choruses even. And I've never heard any of this performed live. Some of it's been recorded. And but, you know, this is before... If you removed the 1,400-odd piano pieces, his output is still enormous. It's just vast.
How do you describe to those who don't know his work... Is it too vast to be able to say there's something to describe it in some way?
No, I think that what is true is that there's almost no two pieces that have the same structure. He was always a very adventurous composer, so he didn't, say, hit on the string quartet or the symphony or something like that and then produce 70 of them like Haydn did. you know, he... And the piano pieces, there's only one sonata. And, you know, and that is such a revolutionary advance on the sonata form as was known at the time. And indeed, it's actually stopped most people in their tracks because nobody's managed a single movement sonata that's better than it ever since. And everyone who's gone back to writing sonatas in several movements seems to be somewhat neoclassical by comparison. I don't know. I think there's the spirit of his music is very individual, and his harmonic language is very easy to pick. he doesn't very often write long-spun tunes, but he is very good at coming up with a motive that you'll never forget once you hear it, like... just because of this falling seventh. You know, you have to pay attention to something that does that, and you wonder what the devil he's going to do with it. And of course, that's one of the big building blocks of the Faust Symphony. But and the way the actual symphony starts. Which the astute members of the audience will already have heard is four augmented triads, all a semitone apart, thus making a 12-note row. And this is a tune that he wrote down the first time in 1847. And so it's quite a long time before Schoenberg thought of it. I don't know. I mean, his best-known piece, I suppose, is a transcription of one of his own songs. This. Language of that, moving all the harmonies around very beautifully while hanging on to one note and keeping it the same. He did it again. There's a symphonic poem called Eruide Funèbre, which is a gigantic funeral march for war dead. And it's in the same key too, the tune, but it goes. Piece that gets very seldom performed, but when it does, it produces a great effect. Bernard Haitink did it with the London Philharmonic years ago in London, and people raced out and bought the record immediately.
Do you see the work of Liszt as a challenge, technical challenge for you as well? Is that part of what draws you to work? I mean, how difficult is it?
I think that's the least interesting part of it altogether.
Really, really.
Everybody knows that Liszt played the piano with great facility, and you expect that the music is not going to be it's not going to be very easy to play, possibly, but in fact it's written so well that it lies there. I mean, it's never easy to play for fully, because you have to study very carefully. These double notes, and any composer who ever writes them knows that you're going to have to study them at some length.
Yeah.
But it all fits, you know, when you're looking to see how you're going to play Scherzo and March, which is a hideously difficult work. Actually, once you get started on it, it works very well. And compared, say, to Schubert, who doesn't write very idiomatically for the piano, which I think Schubert's actually harder to play. Although on the face of it, technically, it doesn't look as hard as Liszt, but there are many more awkward things in Schubert that you have to watch out for, and it's very easy to make bad sounds playing Schubert if you don't watch yourself. And a work like The Wanderer Fantasy is, well, he already thought it was too difficult to play, and Liszt, who can't have found it difficult because he could read almost everything, felt it incumbent upon himself to produce an edition of The Wanderer Fantasy in which he simplified it. I mean, he left the original text there as well,
sure.
but he suggested ways whereby ordinary mortals might get round some of these terrible difficulties that Schubert had put in. You know, when Schubert asks you to go, he just doesn't allow any time for you to move back to where the next arpeggio starts.
Yeah.
You can play the arpeggio, that's all right. If you miss one of these top notes, everyone can hear immediately that you've had a bit of a disaster. So Liszt adds an extra note underneath it, because it's easier to find an octave than a single note with your fifth finger. And also he doesn't let you go the whole way. He just goes. But it actually makes it too easy. So most people who play this piece really try and do it the way Schubert wrote it.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Ah, yes, yes. Which means that very often it's there are little accidents that happen, you know.
Is it true that he was one of the first composers to truly utilize all of the potential of a piano?
Well, not only was he doing that, the way he played the piano was of tremendous influence on the way people built them. And
really?
Oh yes, he had a lot of. He was asked his opinion many, many times by all the big piano manufacturers what they could do to improve. It was certainly true that in his time as a performer, the piano went from the beginnings of iron frame instruments to instruments which are pretty well indistinguishable from modern concert grands. By the time Liszt died, the Steinway with the middle sostenuto pedal already existed. He'd been given one in 1883. But when he started out and on his travels, when he was travelling in those years when he was in his 30s, travelling as a concert pianist all around Europe, he had to deal with some fairly disgraceful machines, especially when he came to England in 1840-41. He brought an Erard piano with him, which they had to take round the coast because the roads in Britain were too bad to be able to transport the piano inland. So when he played inland, he had to use whatever was there, which is what we do now, but now at least we have a beautiful Steinway like this. But, you know, he played some Broadwood Square pianos. Now, you know, these things that, you know, they look, I don't know, just an oblong box, really, with a keyboard let into the side. And there's no real mechanism in those things. The hammer is only attached by a little strip of leather. And so if you really give it a bit of curry, things fly off and come apart. And you know, when Liszt toured, people didn't want him to play Beethoven sonatas. He insisted every now and then playing one, but you know, we take it for granted now that modern recital programs, and Liszt invented the recital, of course, that you know, you'll get a serious evening's entertainment. In those days, it was very rare that there would only be one artist, and you would find people mixing with singers and actors and only playing parts of pieces and being called upon to improvise on themes given by the audience. And In Liszt's case, he was always being asked to play his transcription of the William Tell Overture. He would then insist on playing his transcription of at least the last three movements of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. He improvised on Rule Britannia in almost every town he visited in Britain. I mean, he toured everywhere over these years. And in between, he accompanied all sorts of people, and I expect he met them that afternoon. They gave him the music, and on they went and did it.
When did he sleep?
He didn't sleep very much, because even when he was travelling, his regime was to get up at 5:30 in the morning, and he'd be at his desk working by 6. And if he was travelling, he had a desk and a dummy keyboard mounted in his stagecoach, so he could work en route, and he would work 6 hours a day, at the desk, not counting piano. But of course, we know that later he never practiced the piano at all. He just played every day, and he was teaching every day, and that probably kept him in good enough shape. And since we have the testimonies of so many great musicians who took their compositions to Liszt, who immediately sight-read them root and branch. And, you know, I think, he had such a gift at seeing the potential of a musician. People forget, I think, how much he did just to proselytize for other composers who were having a less comfortable life than he was. I mean, he was working hard for it, but he did make money, which is something that most 19th century composers didn't do very well. And so, you know, he supported Berlioz, and he supported Wagner, and later on he supported Svetlana and Borodin and all sorts and conditions. But, you know, in some cases he met them when they were teenagers and already saw that this is... I mean, when Edward McDowell went to Weimar with his first piano concerto that he composed when he was 17 under his arm, and Liszt took him immediately to Breitkopf and Härtel and arranged for it to be published at his expense. This is the sort of start in life that very few musicians have ever been lucky enough to have. When Glazunov visited Liszt, he was 16, but he did have his first symphony under his belt already, and he gingerly produced it for the old man's inspection. And Liszt immediately arranged for it to be performed in Weimar. And Glazunov, he was absolutely overcome, of course, and dedicated his Second Symphony to Liszt immediately. But you know, that Glazunov at this point had never had a performance outside Russia. And all of a sudden, one of the best orchestras in Europe in one of the most famous musical towns was doing his piece.
Leslie Howard. On Wednesday night at 7:30, he's going to be giving a concert at the Cathedral Church of St. Mark. The performance includes works by Liszt, but also Beethoven and Rachmaninoff. For ticket information, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We now continue our conversation with the pianist Leslie Howard. Next week, Howard is returning to Salt Lake City for a concert. We spoke with him a few years ago in studio and behind a piano.
Anton Rubinstein was born in 1829, and in his lifetime, at any rate, he was a very famous composer indeed. But by the end of his life, I suppose he was more revered as a teacher and as a pianist. And most of his 14 operas and 6 symphonies and 5 piano concertos and such like disappeared, though I'm happy to say there's been a bit of a revival lately. The folks at home all knew this piece. Which outsold the rest of his works put together. Mm. And that's a piece he wrote when he was about 17.
Wow.
And, well, Rubinstein it was who decided that Russian music was far too amateurish. And if you think about most of the composers who'd written and had things seriously performed, say, in the 1830s and 40s, they all held down what one's mother would call a real job and did music as a hobby. That includes, you know, really great people like Glinka. But Rubinstein decided that people needed proper training and they needed to be able to write fugues and know what sonata form was and all of this sort of thing. And he and his brother founded the big conservatories in the principal cities of Russia and set to work training people in the things that they thought were necessary. And so he started writing sonatas and symphonies himself. And this sonata is his first and therefore probably the first serious Russian piano sonata by anybody.
Wow.
And it reflects the fact that his musical interests were not confined within the borders of Russia. I mean, if you just listen to the beginning, you can hear that he certainly knows his Mendelssohn. So, you know, it's good, solid stuff, and he clearly knows what he's up to and how to write. But when you get to the last movement of this piece, he's only a kid, remember?
He's what? He's 19?
The piece was finished before his 19th birthday, because he turned 19 at the end of 1848, and that's when this piece was written. So, you know, the great Russian tradition that most of the Romantics had of writing. They didn't write rondos for finales. They wrote another movement in sonata form, not very different from the first one, except that the second tune usually got much more expansive, and you can think of a dozen examples in the concertos and symphonies of Rachmaninoff, or Tchaikovsky, where the second theme, as it were, developed a life of its own and a length much longer than one was accustomed to in most other countries' sonatas of the period. But he starts writing a tune which you're not really sure that it's ever going to develop into a big theme, but it does. First appearance goes... It's much fuller. Like most of these Russians, when it gets to the development section, he takes the first theme and forgets the second one altogether. The first theme is... he writes a fugue on that. And it's fully worked out, and the whole development section is this fugue. And when you get to the end of it, and you recapitulate the first theme and everything, eventually our second theme comes back, and it's got a trace of the first theme still underneath it. But you can tell this time it's going to go places, and then when it gets to the last two places, last two pages, it really does go, and a kind of texture with repeated chords and arpeggios that I don't think anyone ever dared to do afterwards, but you'll hear what I mean. So you knew how to finish.
Does that reflect... are you sensing that his youth... I think you called this a youthful work...
Oh, it is.
...full of fire and enthusiasm.
Well, an older composer would have stopped repeating maybe a few bars sooner and wouldn't have carried it on right to the end and certainly wouldn't have done those leaps. That's asking for trouble. and certainly his later sonatas don't do anything quite so flamboyant as that. I mean, they're big pieces, but the young lad there is wearing his heart right on his sleeve and just going for it.
Absolutely.
I think it's one of those pieces that really ought to be still in the repertoire, and it's very seldom encountered. And Well, I think I'm the only person still who's ever recorded it. But
wow. I want to ask about the Rachmaninoff. Is it true he really wondered if anyone would ever be able to perform this piece?
He was worried about it. Rachmaninoff was a composer who, as soon as anyone said anything bad about him, he believed it. you know, if anyone wrote a bad criticism of a piece, he took it on board and thought, yes, that really was a very bad piece and I shouldn't have written it. And it actually destroyed his soul on several occasions in his life. The two biggest failures that he had were his first symphony when he was in his 20s and the fourth piano concerto when he was in his, he must have been late 50s. And on both occasions, it more or less stopped him from writing for 4 years. And he just completely got blocked. And he just had a very good creative period. He'd gone to stay in Dresden. And while he was there, he finished his second symphony, which had a much better success than the first. The first is a great piece, by the way, but the rest of us didn't find out about the first symphony until they found the parts that we used for the first performance, because Rachmaninoff thought he'd destroyed it. But anyway, the second symphony turned up in 1907, and while Rachmaninoff was working on that, he was also working on this piano sonata, which is his first, and he only wrote two. And the only sonata he'd written before this was the one for cello and piano, which is a very beautiful piece, and written around the same time as the second concerto, and absolutely full of magnificent melodies, and it's always a big success whenever it's done. The first piano sonata is a very serious affair, and he was inspired by Goethe's Faust, and he wanted to do, just as Liszt had done in his symphony, write three movements, each one of which depicted the characters of Faust, Gretchen, and Mephistopheles. And then, very characteristic of Rachmaninoff, he then didn't want anyone to know that. but we do now, and I don't think it hurts if we know that. Certainly accounts for some of the features of the structure. But somehow or other, while he was writing this, and the last movement is a giant of a thing, and he wrote a letter to one of his friends saying, could you please send me some analytical notes about all of the rondo forms in Mozart sonatas? I really don't understand how to write a rondo, and I'm in the middle of this sonata, and I think I'm making a mess of it, and do I need an extra theme? And, you know, the sort of questions that a 15-year-old kid, you know, doing music theory might ask himself, but certainly not somebody with a great international success as a composer and who knew perfectly well how to write finales, rondos, and you name it. Yeah. And in any case, what he was writing was, as we were mentioning before, a really typical big symphonic movement in sonata form. It's not a rondo at all. So why he's writing these letters expressing his doubts. And then he said that he really couldn't play this piece, and perhaps what he should do is orchestrate it and make it into a symphony. But since he just finished writing a symphony and that one hadn't yet toured the world, I think he just changed his mind. It's very orchestrally written. And then I think he made its career a bit difficult, because being such a wonderful pianist as he was, you would think that he would have given the first performance, as he did of virtually everything that he wrote. But on this occasion, because he was outside Russia and he wanted it to be first performed in Russia, he entrusted a copy of the manuscript to Konstantin Igumnov, who was quite a player. There are some recordings of his work. And Igumnov played the piece in Moscow and reported back to Rachmaninoff. And Rachmaninoff wasn't pleased, not at the performance, just with the piece. And he subjected it to some revision before it was published and sent it back to Igumnov in a revised version. And this is the only reason we know, because Rachmaninoff normally is very secretive about his compositional processes. But Igumnov wrote that, you know, the 60 bars had gone from the finale and all sorts of things had been changed and it had been tightened up, and he did agree that it was much better. And he went out and, of course, had to relearn it.
Yeah.
Terribly difficult thing to do, because, you know, if you've ever learned a version of a piece, as I know to my cost with all that Liszt, because Liszt was forever revising things, and, you know, if you carry two versions of the same work in your head, the danger of slipping from one to the other is just terrible. And anyway, this sonata was finally played by Rachmaninoff himself in 1908. And he kept it in his recital programs for about 3 years, and then after that dropped it because people thought it was too serious. Mm. I think it's one of those pieces which repays a careful listen. It's actually quite easy to follow because it's made out of very small cells which are very easy to remember. For example, that comes really out of just, and you can hang on to that fairly easily, I think. And then one additional motive. The second theme is almost not a tune at all. And that's very unusual for Rachmaninoff because, you know, we all know what his second themes can be like, and they can range over three octaves like they do in the Second Symphony, which is the work nearest to this one. But in fact, this piece looks forward in many ways to the work that Rachmaninoff was to write next, which is his fantastic symphonic poem called The Isle of the Dead, which is also made out of just tiny little cells. But this second tune, which is, it's actually very moving, and it's only after you've heard it that you stop and think, but hang on, he just did that with two notes, didn't he? go. Off he goes. Mm. But he hangs on to that little cell for so long that when he finally lets it grow out of its chrysalis, it's just you can't forget it, how it worked. And this whole sonata comes about like that. And when that comes the second time, he already gives you the theme of the second movement before he finishes the first one. Mm. And you have a it's got a cadenza in it, almost like a concerto, but we're dealing with this character, Faust, who's being invited to sell his soul to the devil in order to experience the pleasure and joy that he sees in other people's lives but can't feel for himself.
Mm. I need to warn you, there's about a minute left.
We better not rattle too much longer then. But all of a sudden you have... this, which he's just using to finish a movement, then kicks off the next one, and then the last one is full of really blood and guts, and his favourite tune, which is the Dies Irae, which he uses in anything that has got the faintest Mephistophelian flavour to it. Anyway, I think this sonata is a real cracker, and it's just... It's a mountainous work, so it's seldom attempted, but I think it's worth the effort.
Leslie Howard, This Wednesday night at 7:30, he's going to be performing at the Cathedral Church of St. Mark in Salt Lake City. The concert includes works by Liszt, but also Beethoven and Rachmaninoff. For details, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.